From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
He knew that I was getting ready to file these civil rights lawsuits of excluding blacks from serving in politics, serving in city government, and so forth. So as clever as he is, he then went to the white community and persuaded them that it were better that they took some small measures of integration than let have the federal courts come in, and as he put it, the niggers would take over everything.
Joseph P. Smitherman. He's in a runoff election today in Selma. His tenure goes back to 1964, when he presided over Bloody Sunday. Civil rights activists were beat by protests by police. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Primaries are being held in 8 states across the country today, in one of the most significant congressional races in recent years. In the House, a minuscule shift of 6 seats to the Democrats would alter the direction of the congressional agenda. Stakes are also high in the Senate race, where Democrats are less likely to gain the 4 seats needed to take a majority. We'll have more on today's primaries later in the program. With a plea agreement so close he can almost touch it, Wen Ho Lee returned to solitary confinement even as defense lawyers and prosecutors tried to iron out their differences over setting the scientist free. Government officials had announced Sunday that Lee would agree to plead guilty to one of the 59 counts against him, downloading restricted material to an unsecured computer, and be sentenced to the 9 months he's already served in jail. He's about to go home a free man. But a snag was announced by both sides at the beginning of yesterday's plea hearing, and U.S. District Judge James Parker gave the lawyers 2 more days. Lee was fired from Los Alamos in March of 99, and 9 months later was charged with downloading restricted nuclear data to unsecure computers and tapes. He could have faced life in prison if convicted of all 59 counts. But the case began disintegrating last month at a renewed bail hearing. FBI agent Robert Mesimer, whose testimony was key in initially denying Lee bail in December, said he repeatedly erred in that testimony. Under the deal described Sunday by government sources, Lee was expected to drop allegations that he was targeted because he's Chinese, claims included in a civil lawsuit against the FBI and the U.S. Departments of Energy and Justice. This from Richmond, Virginia. Today, defense lawyers hope to persuade a federal judge to halt the execution of a convicted killer and find out why key evidence briefly vanished. The court has become Derek Barnabé's only hope to avoid execution by injection Thursday night, after Governor Jim Gilmore ruled out clemency yesterday. Key evidence, including material that underwent DNA testing, vanished from August 29th to September 1st, and Gilmore has ordered a state police investigation into the disappearance. This news from Lima, Peru, a beer commercial shoot that damaged a stone sundial in the famous Inca ruins of Machu Picchu has drawn harsh criticism from archaeologists and politicians who say not enough is being done to preserve the 500-year-old stone city. Machu Picchu lies high in the jungle-covered Andes about 300 miles southeast of the capital, Lima. A jutting edge of the sundial, the length of a ballpoint pen, was chipped off last Friday when a 1,000-pound crane used to film a beer commercial toppled over. The commercial was shot by the U.S. publicity firm J. Walter Thompson for beer company Cervecer, a subsidiary of Brew's largest beer company, Bacchus and Johnston. Protests over fuel are spreading throughout Europe as protesters and union leaders today called for European governments to slash fuel taxes, vowing to continue demonstrations that have snarled traffic, blockaded refineries, and led panicked motorists to stock up on gasoline. Truckers, taxi drivers, farmers, tour operators, and others who say high oil prices are hurting their businesses continue protesting in Britain, Belgium, the Netherlands, and France. Both the British and German governments say they would not follow the example of France, which agreed to demands to subsidize fuel prices. Indonesian officials today say Indonesia is considering buying Russian military aircraft for the first time since 1965, sidestepping a U.S. arms embargo. Navy Chief Admiral said his service wants 4 MiL-17 helicopters to deploy Marines in the country's trouble spots. Western nations, particularly the United States, have supplied military equipment to Indonesia for decades, but the countries have embargoed weapons supplies to Jakarta after the Indonesian military razed East Timor last year. President Clinton has been attempting to restore that military funding. Secretary of Defense William Cohen is headed to Jakarta this week. And this news from Portland, Oregon, anti-abortion activists are today asking a federal appeals court to overturn a $109 million verdict by a jury that decided a website and posters listing the names of doctors who perform abortion and clinics where those abortions are performed were threats that went beyond free speech. The case is widely seen as a test of a Supreme Court ruling that defined a threat as explicit language likely to cause, quote, imminent lawless action, and a measure of how far anti-abortionists can go in harrying doctors and clinics.
Train a coming. You don't need no baggage. You just get on board. Oh, all you need is faith to hear the diesels humming. You don't need no ticket. You just thank the Lord.
Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The people of Selma, Alabama, will be going to the polls today in the runoff election between longtime Mayor Joe Smitherman and black businessman James Perkins Jr. A city where African-American majority has fought for the right to vote, Mayor Smitherman is a living legend of racist intimidation and voter fraud. In Smitherman's 37 years as Selma's mayor, he once publicly referred to Martin Luther King Jr. as Martin Luther Coon. And he fired the first black school superintendent because he worked to end classroom segregation in Selma's public school system. 35 years ago this summer, Selma embedded itself in America's memory as an important part of the nation's civil rights struggle when activists made history on the march from Selma to Montgomery. The goal of the more than 50-mile trek was to bring attention to discriminatory policies that kept blacks from voting. Peaceful marchers were beaten bloody by troopers who were supposed to protect them, while America watched from their living rooms. Mayor Smitherman made his national television debut during that march, known as Bloody Sunday. He was the mayor in charge when the police attacked the protesters with clubs and tear gas. Well, Selma isn't a town frozen in time. Years of grassroots organizing and voter registration have led to today's Joe Gotta Go campaign, fighting to unseat Smitherman. Black voter registration and turnout are up since Perkins lost to Smitherman 4 years ago by a mere 325 votes. In today's election, independent observers have been called in to monitor the voting process. In the second half of the program, we're going to talk to activists in Selma, Alabama. How has Joe Smitherman maintained his power for 35 years? But first, we're going to turn to J.L. Chestnut, a civil rights attorney and author of Black in Selma, The Uncommon Life of J.L. Chestnut, Jr., autobiography of a pioneering civil rights attorney. He came into WBAI's studios just a little while ago, and the first question I asked him was about Joe Smitherman and just who he is.
Joseph T. Smitherman, a white man, 1 year older than I am. Ironically, he and Martin Luther King, the same age. Joe Smitherman was the mayor at the time of these demonstrations in the 60s. He has been the mayor continuously since then, but for 2 years when he just walked away from it. And how he has managed that in a predominantly black town, I think says so much about America. When I went back, he knew that I was getting ready to file these civil rights lawsuits of excluding blacks from serving in politics, serving in city government, and so forth. So as clever as he is, he then went to the white community and persuaded them that it were better that they took some small measures of integration than have the federal courts come in, and as he put it, the niggers would take over everything. So, and they agreed to that in desperation. So that brought some blacks into City Hall for the first time. And he told the blacks that he was doing that because it was right. And he was insisting that they have equality. It took some time, but he was going to see to that. And then a little bit later on, because of the Civil Rights Movement and because Selma was such a symbol, all kind of federal money was just flowing into Selma from the Lyndon Johnson administration. But, of course, all of you could not discriminate when you received that money. So he had to go out and hire all these black people. And blacks didn't really understand that. And Joe was running around telling them he was doing it because it was right. And he really built a solid black base. I suspect, well, I know that he could not have remained in power all these years without solid black support. But I think that that says so much about America. It says so much about the politics of America and race relations and how we operate in this country.
We're talking to J.L. Chestnut Jr. He is the first black lawyer of Selma, Alabama, and has written a book called Black in Selma, The Uncommon Life of J.L. Chestnut Jr., Politics and Power in a Small American City. We're seeing a lot of protests right now. I just came back from Philadelphia, the Republican National Convention, headed to Los Angeles for the Democratic Convention. Before that, Washington, protests against the World Bank and IMF. Before that, the major protests in Seattle. But you go back decades, engaged in very serious civil rights protests. Can you talk about how you came to be a lawyer? I mean, singular, you're the first black lawyer of Selma.
Well, having been born in Selma, one had to try and do what one could do to address a terrible and unbelievable situation. When I went back there in 1959, crazy enough to hang out a shingle as the first black lawyer, only 150 black folk out of a pool of 30,000 were registered to vote. And each one of these had to be vouched for by a white person. If a white person didn't say old Ned was all right, old Ned didn't get registered. There were black and white water fountains, black and white restrooms. My mother, my wife, and black women couldn't try on a pair of shoes in a department store. The police did whatever to whomever in the black community, and nobody dared ask a question. They were the law. When they knocked on your door, if they bothered to knock at all, and you said, who is it? They didn't say representatives of the law. They said the law because they were the law. And the blacks had no rights that white folk were bound to respect. No black person had served on a jury in Alabama in 150 years. So I went back to try and help address that. Martin King and I had known him a year earlier in the Montgomery bus boycott, which is just 50 miles from Selma. And he had, interestingly, I had planned to come to Selma and set up, come to New York and set up a law practice in Harlem. I was a sort of protege for Adam Clayton Powell. But it was Martin King who was going around the country trying to organize what became the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he was saying, J.L., you need to come back to Alabama. That's where the action is. It won't be in New York. That's how Vivian and I wound up back there in that struggle. And, of course, before I knew it, the civil rights struggle just exploded in the streets of Selma. Amy, it's interesting, though. At that time, we were not struggling over the right to vote. The struggle was over the right to breathe, to be free. A lot of people missed that. It translated later on into a right to vote when we found out how important the right to vote was to the right to breathe. When Rosa Parks stood up on that, refused to stand up on that Montgomery bus, it was not about voting. It was about the right to breathe, to be a human being.
Tell us about the protest of teachers.
Well, teachers were pretty much hemmed in because they worked for a county board of education, and it was very difficult to get them involved in a protest demonstration there in Selma. But they were really embarrassed because their children were out protesting and teasing them. How can you teach civics and you can't even vote? How can you teach government? You're not part of the government. So they were going through a terrible time when one of the most prominent women in Selma, Mrs. Amelia Boynton, who is now a world traveler. I hardly ever see her, but has to be at least 90-something, but she's still going all over the world. But she was seriously manhandled and hurt. And that traveled through the black community, and it shocked so many people that the teachers, actually, about 150 of them, to everybody's amazement, got out and marched down to the courthouse.
Who was she hurt by?
By Jim Clark, the bully sheriff there, who was walking around like General Patton or something with a helmet on and big swagger stick and always three or four creases in the back of his shirt. And he was a huge man. You could always see him stand out in the crowd. And he never did understand that was exactly what we wanted. He was the perfect symbol. He was better than Bull Connor. It took us, Bull Connor, who was in Birmingham, it took us some time to convince Martin King that Jim Clark was a bigger fool than Bull Connor. And after Martin got one look at him, he winked his eye and said, "Yes, we found him."
So you got Martin Luther King to come to Selma.
Yeah, it took us 2 years to do that. Martin was concerned about Selma. He'd been to Birmingham. He knew what that was. He knew he had Bull Connor, who would act a fool. And you had to have that in order to get the focus of the national media. Also, Birmingham was urban and compact. You could communicate. You could organize. Selma is more rural. Many people were still living on plantations and so forth. And Martin was just concerned as to whether or not you could establish a movement in that kind of setting. And he was not sure that we could find a Bull Connor. And we kept telling him that Selma was the ticket, not Birmingham. Birmingham at that time was really literally owned by United States Steel. And absentee landlords, they really didn't care what happened in Birmingham. And we finally persuaded Martin to come in. What he did, actually, he went back to Birmingham and Selma. He reached a kind of compromise decision. And it was crucial that he came to Selma.
J.L. Chestnut, a civil rights attorney in Selma, Alabama. Black in Selma is the name of his autobiography, The Uncommon Life of J.L. Chestnut, Jr. When we come back, more on a background in Selma, Alabama, where an historic runoff is taking place, will Joseph Smitherman, 37 years as Selma's mayor, be re-elected? The man who, in 1964, was also mayor when the police attacked protesters on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll also be speaking with Joseph Smitherman's opponent. Stay with us. Mm-hmm. We're talking to J.L. Chestnut, Jr. He is the first black lawyer of Selma, Alabama, and has written a book called Black in Selma, The Uncommon Life of J.L. Chestnut, Jr., Politics and Power in a Small American City. Let's talk about the really pioneering lawsuits that you brought in Selma. Democracy Now! Began as the only daily election show in public broadcasting in 1996, and now we've come full cycle to the year 2000. What about those suits when you first returned to Selma?
Well, we were bringing lawsuits first in the context of the criminal law. You must remember there were no civil rights laws at that time that amounted to anything. These would come in 64, 65. We were bringing lawsuits saying that it was unconstitutional to systematically exclude blacks from jury service. And then you could never win that sort of case in Alabama, but we'd build a record, take it through the courts of Alabama, and the legal defense, NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, Thurgood Marshall's old outfit, Jack Greenberg, those people, they would pick these cases up and take them to the United States Supreme Court. So we were trying to do through the criminal law what the Congress later did by passing civil rights statutes. It took us, I don't know how long, to integrate the state of Alabama, the schools of Alabama, and we thought it would take twice as long. But George Wallace, Joe Smitherman was idle. George Wallace came on the scene and said that as the governor of Alabama, he was the executive head of every public school in Alabama. I couldn't believe he'd said that. So we just promptly sued him, and instead of having to go county by county, we integrated schools of Alabama in half the time. But it was a tremendous struggle. And as always, we didn't have enough money. We didn't have enough people, but we just kept struggling. And day by day, we worked it all out. The most interesting litigation that I'm involved in now is a suit on behalf of 25,000 black farmers across the United States. To this point, the government has paid $300 million to poor black farmers. By its own estimates, when this is over with, it will have paid in excess of $1 billion to poor black farmers. That is the largest civil rights settlement in the history of this country. It also involves the gatekeeper, the United States Department of Agriculture, the last plantation. This is the government that's supposed to be watching everybody else. What we found was that USDA, which is the second largest entity within the huge federal establishment, nothing's larger than USDA but the Pentagon, and it's larger because it has the Army and the Navy. And USDA has an active presence in every county in the United States, in all of the possessions. And it operates through local committees. These are the most well-connected, richest white farmers in each county. They decide who will get what, if anything, from Washington. So black farmers all over this country for the last 30 years have been unable to get loans from USDA to which they were entitled. If they got the loan came too late after the planting season. And how you serviced the loan the previous year determines your credit, whether you can get it the next year. Just a few years ago, there must have been 36,000 small black farmers in this country. You'd be lucky to find 6,000 now. And in 1983, the Reagan administration abolished the entire civil rights infrastructure within USDA, which meant that if the poor black farmer was when he was discriminated against, he was nowhere to appeal it to. So we brought this lawsuit, and the judge said, "Mr. Chestnut, how much money are you asking for?" And I said, $2 billion. And he and the government laughed, because there is no precedent in this government for paying real money to people of color. Never. When the Japanese were in turn at the beginning of World War II, They got about, 40 years later, they got about $25,000 per person. When they inflicted all these black men with syphilis, the government in Tuskegee, they got about $35,000. We're getting black farmers now $50,000 each. All of their credit is being forgiven, and on it goes. It's a huge lawsuit.
When does it end? What's the next step?
Well, we are now paying off. A monitor has been appointed by the court to monitor this situation for 6 years after the lawsuit shuts down. We had this problem. This is a civil rights lawsuit, and you can't win a civil rights lawsuit without adequate documentation. You need the paperwork. And farmers, black or white, are notorious. They don't have paper. They're not notary publics or lawyers. They're farmers. They don't keep papers. The second problem we had was that there is a statute of limitations. If you're going to sue USDA for discrimination, you have to do it within 2 years of the act. And all of these people were pretty much out because the 2 years had run. The President of the United States got with, of all persons, Newt Gingrich, who was then the Speaker of the House. And in the omnibus federal budget, which is the size of the New York Telephone Directory, they stuck in one little paragraph which waived the statute of limitations on behalf of these black farmers. That is the first time that has happened in the history of this country. And we, to get around the fact that these farmers didn't have papers, we entered into a settlement with the government and set up what we call Track A and Track B. A Track A farmer simply makes a declaration that he went down on a such and such a date to his county USDA office and applied for a loan, and they discriminated against him. And then he needs only one person who is not his family member who will attest to that, and that's easy because in most counties, a whole part of any black got financed. They just declare on behalf of each other. So that gets around all this paperwork. It's a huge lawsuit.
Mr. Chestnut, what is your greatest accomplishment?
Well, I don't know if that's a question I have not thought that much about. I am proud of the fact that I served with Martin Luther King as his lawyer, as his friend, and I learned how to manage fear. And through him, I think I grew to a level that otherwise would not have been the case. There is something very special about extraordinary people such as Martin King. In a different sort of way, H. Rapp Brown has that sparkle or whatever it is, too. And it's been Dick Gregory has it. And I think having been able to serve and grow with people like that is perhaps my largest or best achievement.
And what about, as you look back at this century, a good portion of which you have lived, what you think have been the greatest accomplishments in general for African Americans and the greatest setbacks, where we have to go?
Well, in Selma, Alabama, after the bloody beating, March 7, 1965, on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and the President of the United States addressed the Congress and asked them to pass the Voting Rights Bill, which they did. We in Selma went in 6 weeks from 150 black registered voters to 10,000. I don't know if that has ever happened anywhere else in the history of the human race. As you look about you now, in the Congress, everywhere else, there are blacks serving at every level of government, state, federal, and municipal, and in the Congress. And there are all kinds of great progress that has grown out of that struggle, that law. But at the same time, we have to recognize the fact that some 35 million African Americans in this country probably take in $900 billion a year. And we have people living in public housing and trying to survive on food stamps. And one of the reasons that's true is because a dollar bill does not remain in the black community long enough to sneeze at. And if you can't turn a dollar over at least twice, you might as well not have had it, particularly in this citadel of capitalism. We spend everything we get our hands on, and we spend it oftentimes with our enemies, our political enemies. Also, as you look about America, you find that we don't own any of the means of production. We own very little land. I just told you what has happened to the black farmer. This is a continuing recipe, in my view, for disaster. And we have to address these serious problems. I'm very interested in what Jesse Jackson and some others are doing on Wall Street. I hope that that bears fruit. We spend $1 million a day in national supermarkets, chains, and we don't own a single one. We keep these hotels going. We don't own a single one. This is where the next struggle will be. We're no longer arguing about where we're going to ride on the bus. We're arguing about owning the damn bus.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by the first black lawyer of Selma, Alabama. His name is J.L. Chestnut, Jr., intimately involved with the civil rights protests of the 60s, now the lawyer for H. Rapp Brown and many others. H. Rapp Brown, whose current name is?
Jamil Amin.
Actually, why don't we start on his case? He's been charged with murder and attempted murder.
Yes.
Of two sheriffs.
Deputy sheriffs.
Deputy
Fulton
sheriffs.
Fulton County.
My question about that, I remember at the time when the shootout occurred and then he went into hiding, that they said that the person who did it had been shot himself.
Yes. They have now backed away from that somewhat. Once they found out that there was not a scratch on Al-Amin, they said that there was a pool of blood. They didn't necessarily say the shooter was shot. But we have television tape and other situations where they did make that statement. They also said that they followed a trail of blood to a certain house. They are now backing away from that in part. I just think they spoke too soon. There's a whole lot going on in this case. It's not nearly the cinch-type case that they made it out to be in those days when they were had just captured Al-Amin.
Mm-hmm. Where is he being held now?
He's being held in the Fulton County Jail in Atlanta. He's being held with 3,000 other young black inmates, all between the ages of 17 and 30. Not one white person is locked up there. And he was telling me the other day that that really concerns him, because this is the reproductive age group, and with AIDS really increasing so much among that age group, he wonders where we will be in the year 2020. He's also has a great presence also inside prisons. When they move him in, that's really a county jail, but it's built like a prison. When they move him about inside that prison, all these young inmates began beating on walls and bars with tin cups, just repeating his name, Jamil, Jamil, Jamil. It's almost eerie, and it scares his handlers to death. He had the same impact when he was in jail in Montgomery, Alabama. The sheriff there actually had a military tank patrolling the block around the prison.
This was in the 60s.
No. This was the last month or so.
Oh.
Yeah, in Montgomery, Alabama.
Oh.
And I spoke with the sheriff. I said, what are you expecting? What is all of this security? And he couldn't. give any kind of decent answer. And in that Montgomery, Alabama jail, whenever Jamil would convert an inmate to Islam, they would move him to a different floor, so they was constantly moving him. So he's a sort of spiritual man with a tremendous presence, even in jail. Jails don't affect him, but he certainly affects his jailers.
You were describing earlier how you had gone to see him and then headed off to Hank Aaron's estate in Atlanta, and the former H. Rap Brown gave you a message.
Sure. Johnny Cochran, who is now, in a sense, franchising himself as a lawyer, and lawyers all around the country are joining up with Johnny and becoming his associates or franchisees in a sort of national law firm. And apparently Hank Aaron was so impressed with that he opened this huge and wonderful estate and home he has there in Atlanta to honor Johnny. Also, Hank Aaron used that as an opportunity to raise a ton of money for his favorite museum, a black museum there in Atlanta. And I am from Selma, Alabama, and I was invited to this glittering affair. Some of the wealthiest black folk in this country were there. And I stopped by the county jail to talk with Jamil first, and I told him where I was headed to. And he fired laughing. He said, "I want you to deliver a message." And I said, "Sure, what's the message?" He said, "Tell them that I said I am so concerned that so many educated blacks and so-called black leaders are hustling for crumbs, and political and otherwise, that if the full loaf accidentally fell from White's table, it would hit them in the top of the head." And I repeated that to all of these folk coming up in these long lines of white limousines and dressed to kill, well coughed and everything. And there was some nervous laughter, but not much. But Jamil, I said to my dear wife, I said, "I see Jamil is not only having an impact inside the jail, now he's having an impact out at the Aaron estate."
J.L. Chestnut, civil rights attorney and author of Black and Selma, The Uncommon Life of J.L. Chestnut, Jr., Politics and Power in a Small American City. And we're going to go to that city after the break. And as voters hit polling stations in the mayoral runoff election today in Selma, Alabama, we'll talk with some of the voting rights activists about the race, where Joseph Smitherman is hoping to be mayor again, as he was, well, all the way back to 1964, as he presided over Bloody Sunday, when police attacked voting rights activists crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'll be back in a minute.
3, 4. Thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The people of Selma, Alabama, going to the polls today in the runoff election between longtime Mayor Joe Smitherman and black businessman James Perkins Jr. In a city where the African-American majority has fought for the right to vote, Mayor Smitherman is a living legend. He's 37 years as Selma's mayor. He once referred to Martin Luther King Jr. as Martin Luther Coon, and he fired the first black school superintendent because he worked to end classroom segregation in Selma's public school system. We're joined right now by a number of people who are involved with today's runoff election. Latosha Brown is the co-director of the 21st Youth Leadership Movement. Senator Hank Sanders is Alabama State Senator. And Reverend Charles White Jr. is the Southeast Regional Director of the NAACP. He's poll watching today. Let's start with Senator Hank Sanders. Describe the climate in Selma right now and what this race is all about.
Well, the climate in Selma now is unusual. I haven't seen this much energy since the early 70s, particularly when it comes to the issue of voting. It's unusual. It's it's a moment that's pregnant with energy, with expectation, with hope, with fear. It's just a very, very unusual moment, and I think it's a moment of history making.
Latosha Brown, how are you involved in today's runoff election?
I have been working a lot in terms of getting the vote out and getting young people excited about going to the polls. Normally, that age between 18 and 35, that's the lowest voter turnout age bracket. So we've been being creative and getting people, getting young people excited and energized about going to the polls. And I do think that we're going to see a higher turnout with young people between the ages of 18 and 35 that we've seen.
What's the racial breakdown of Selma right now?
65-35.
65 African-American?
Yes.
35 white.
And in 1970, the census threw it up to 1980. It was like 52-48. And it's been changing. Folks been moving out, and folks been so this is a this kind of a division is something that has happened a lot in the last 10 years.
Reverend Charles White, what could you describe how it is that Joseph Smitherman has won for so many elections in Selma, Alabama, going right back to 1964 and Bloody Sunday?
Well, it's been very interesting to observe locally the kind of politics that is happening here in Selma, Alabama. One of the things that I'm most impressed with is the incredible grassroots work that has been done by several community-based organizations. And I think the emerging of those organizations are bringing about a change in this community. So I think that supporting efforts as Latosha and other young people who have been very creative in involving now in the political process, young voters, and the extraordinary effort of just the entire faith community of getting people involved. I think it's a change as Selma serves as such an icon to many across the world. It's a change now developing in Selma, and I think we're going to see great things even from this point on. The kind of community momentum that the senator is speaking of has been very evident to those NAACPers who have come for our stay here in Selma. It's been very interesting. It's been a feeling that has captivated us and also given us a sense of belonging and feeling at home. We all feel some sense of belonging to this place.
Well, we've just been joined
about just a little bit, if you don't mind.
Yes, Senator Hank Sanders.
Okay. He has managed to stay here because he has been very skillful at the divide and conquer, both the white community and the black community. He tells the white community that if blacks take over, all of them going to be run out of town. It's going to be all kind of problem. They're going to lose everything. For years, he also told the black community that if it wasn't for him stopping the white community, then they would do terrible things to the black people. So he was literally using race to manipulate both sides. He was very skillful at finding ways to entice folks. So if you're in office that long, you get an opportunity when you're mayor to entice some folks. The ones he couldn't entice, he then manipulated. And if he couldn't entice you or manipulate it, then he launched very vicious attacks on you as a symbol to other kinds of folks. Those are the kinds of tactics that has allowed him to be able to stay in office for these number of years.
Well, it's gone on for quite a while. I do have to say we invited Joseph Smitherman to be a guest on today's program. His office declined, but James Perkins Jr. is with us, and he is the mayoral challenger and has been challenging Joseph Smitherman for a number of years. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
So tell us how long you've been challenging Smitherman for mayor.
Well, it feels like since 1965. Hi, Senator Sanders and Latasha and Reverend White. Hello, everybody.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm no newcomer to Selma and to struggle. I have been directly involved in Selma politics even as a child in 1984, and that's in my adult life. When Dr. F.D. Reed, the first serious African-American challenger, ran for mayor, I was his campaign manager. In 1992 and 96, I challenged the mayor, and each time we've inched a little closer. This time we intend to cross the river.
Why do you think this year is different?
Well, the energy is different. We have been able to form coalitions of voters and to forge and bridge relationships that in the past have not existed. And I think this time around we have been able to just mobilize people that have never voted before. I have many young people, Latasha, thanks to the effort of you guys, NAACP, and many others who have been out working with Joe Gotta Go and Moving Forward United for the yeoman's effort that's been put in and mobilizing and energizing the community. But people are very passionate about this race. They really genuinely feel that it is time for us to move beyond where we are. It's time to move the Honorable Mayor to the history books and out of City Hall.
Can you tell us, James Perkins, what you've been doing over the years? What is your profession?
I'm an information technology professional. I worked for Fortune 500s early in my career, and then I started my own business between 1980 and 1998. So for 18 years, I was an entrepreneur and business owner in the information technology world, and software engineering primarily, and project and program management.
There's been a Joe Gotta Go campaign that's been organized. Latasha Brown, talk about what your voter mobilization effort is all about. Exactly what is your strategy?
Well, one of the things that we've been doing is really trying to find out with those undervotes. There are a lot of people that simply have not participated in the process for one reason or the other. Many people that we've talked to, that we went out in the community to talk to, they said that they didn't participate. One, because they didn't connect to the issues. They didn't really understand how that vote, whether or not they went to the polls to vote, how that really made a difference. So several things, approaches we had. One was just making the issues, breaking the issues down where people see where it's relevant to them. When people, the idea of being able to attract new industry, that in itself, that's real for people because that's income, that's livelihood. And then moving on from just connecting those issues, the second thing is motivating people. You know, people have been here so long. We're in a city that has been very oppressive. We're in a city that opportunities have been very limited. You know, and sometimes people just feel like, oh, well, what the heck? You know, we keep doing this year after year. So we had to create a new excitement because when you do the same things, you keep getting the same results. So we had to change up the game a little bit and make sure that we went out into the community and connected and created some energy and some excitement. I think one of the things that happened a little differently, we had young people taking a leadership where they were actually going connecting to their peers. And for them to see their peers out there in the streets and really passionate about supporting Mr. Perkins, I think that that also drew them in. And there were several, we had rallies throughout the city. One of the things we did is we went into different communities, and we had rallies where we pulled people out of their homes and, you know, just talked to them about the importance of voting. And I think another element has been people that live outside of Selma to come in has also been able to create some excitement. But we haven't started on this campaign just a month ago or 2 months ago. This has been a long process. This has been a process in which, you know, for the last years we've been working on ways to, you know, to gain the community's support and to make sure that people are engaged in the process the entire way, so people know that it's a movement. It's not just an election, but they feel a part of something much greater, a part of a movement, a part of a movement of change. With such high unemployment rates, particularly for young people, I know most of my peers, once they went off to college, they leave and they don't come back to this area. So one of the things that we've been really pushing, this idea that with this new mayor who is actively on this platform, Mr. Perkins is consistent in talking about bringing new industry into Selma, and you can't catch fish unless you throw your hook out. So we have a mayor that is that has not thrown his hook out for personal reasons, but now with a new mayor and throwing out that foot, that fish hook to attract new industry, that in itself has created a whole lot of excitement.
Can I just add briefly that two additional things. One is that many people just simply put their life on the line and became human billboards, and simply day after day would hold up Joe Gotta Go sign. That was a street tactic that helped to energize the city. There was also ads put on the radio earlier on about Joe Gotta Go. The whole mobilization took place from a number of directions, and I think that that's one of the key. That was just two other components of it.
State Senator Hank Sanders, Reverend Charles White, you're the Southeast Regional Director of the NAACP. What does it mean to be out watching polls today? During the Republican convention, I was talking to some South Carolina delegates where there had been very serious accusations in places like Greenville and Spartanburg that in the last election, polling places in black areas were closed.
Yes, and we received those complaints, or in the state conference in South Carolina has been following through with a very thorough investigation and working with the election commission there in South Carolina. I mean, Selma is very interesting. I mean, the NAACP is very concerned that the polls here open at 8 a.m. and close at 6 p.m. This makes it extremely difficult for working people to vote. We've heard of other allegations. The NAACP is mindful of these allegations and will be observing today the election to see what actually takes place. We will monitor, evaluate, and then decide what, if any, further action must be taken to ensure the right of Selma's citizens to vote freely and fairly.
Here in New York, the polling places today, this is in, for example, the Democratic primary where Hillary Clinton is hoping to get the Democratic nomination for the Senate. The polls open at 6. Why 8? Who decides that in Alabama?
That is something that's decided by the city council and the mayor, and that has been an ongoing battle. Even the NAACP got involved in that in the 96 race, and in fact, the polls were open from 8 to 7 in 96 because of that effort. But the existing council made a conscious decision to move that time back. We have to recognize that we are not a monolithic people, and people are responding to different kinds of things, and I think that council has been reacting to the mayor's overtures of fear and reprisal, and we're going to try not to hold it against them. I've been encouraging our people to just continue to stand on faith, to continue to work real hard, and at the end we'll give God the glory for the victory.
James Perkins, Jr., your major planks in your platform.
Well, I have been very consistent in talking about education, how we will educate our children educate the unemployed and the underemployed adults in our community. I've talked consistently about economic development, the fact that we have 18% unemployment in our city when the state currently enjoys a 4%, a national 4% average, somewhere thereabouts. We have depression-level economic conditions, and when the rest of the nation's booming. I've talked consistently about truth and reconciliation and about creating a Selma plan. We have been operating in our city for the past 20, 25 years without a plan, if you can believe that. We've been operating under a mayor who did not even see fit to create an organization chart for the city government. And so there are tremendous amount. I did not have to go far and look hard to find key issues that really directly affect the quality of life of the citizens. And we've talked about them consistently, and I think the people understand them now, and I think they understand how it affects how we live, where we live, and under what leadership we live. And I think they are ready now. And, in fact, this will probably be the last interview I do between now and 6 o'clock. I'm sitting down, and I'm allowing the citizens now to stand up, go to the polls, vote their conviction, vote their passion, and I am in prayer that that will be a vote of faith and not of fear.
Let's see. On August 22nd, Smitherman forced into the runoff. He received 46% of the vote. You got 43%, and City Council President Pro Tem Yusuf Salam got 11%. And now it's just between you and Smitherman.
That's right. In fact, I'd like to do one other breakdown for you. At the polls on Election Day, I carried 47% of the vote. The mayor carried 43%. The major significant difference came in the absentee ballot box when the mayor actually outpolled me 2-1, and that reversed who led going into this runoff. The absentee ballot box is a very substantial box. Even in this race, there have been 1,900 absentee ballots requested by citizens, and as of yesterday, over 1,500 had been returned, and so we recognize that that is still an uphill climb. The state of Alabama, and I'll be getting back with our senator after this election is over, because our state laws actually encourage high-volume activity in the absentee ballot box. When you have problems in your polling place, the greater the volume, the less likely it is that you can change the outcome of an election. We need to change that because that provides an incentive for people to do the things that we've been doing.
We only have 10 seconds. You think
sure.
You're going to bring Al Gore in on your coattails?
Well, I think the whole nation, again, will benefit from the outcome of this election in Selma.
Well, James Perkins, Jr., mayoral challenger to Joe Smitherman there for 37 years. I want to thank you for being with us and doing this last interview with us on your election day. Latosha Brown of the 21st Youth Leadership Movement, State Senator Hank Sanders, and Reverend Charles L. White of the NAACP. Democracy Now! Produced by Jillian Aldrich and Sidrock Franklin's. Special thanks to Deepa Fernandez. I'm Amy Goodman. Matthew Finch, our engineer. Thanks for listening.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science, as well as issues concerning war, peace, and the environment. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science and politics. Our lead story today comes from the state of California. By a unanimous decision of the California Air Resources Board, they have held the course, and they now demand that 10% of all cars offered for sale in California starting in the year 2003 shall emit little or no pollution whatsoever. A tremendous victory for environmentalists, and of course the automobile industry is going to try to fight that tooth and nail. Also, bad news from the environment. It turns out that satellites and other monitoring devices have shown that over the South Pole, a hole three times the size of the United States has opened up in the ozone layer. Although there have been victories in terms of reining in pollution that will create ozone depletion, this represents a very sobering fact that human activity can definitely rip apart very precious layers of the Earth's atmosphere. And also some interesting news from the medical front. The aging process is gradually being revealed to have genetic as well as chemical origins. This time, the lowly nematode worm, whose genome has been completely sequenced by scientists, was bathed in antioxidant fluids, and scientists were able to lengthen their lifespan by 50%. And this is beginning to shed light on the precise mechanisms of the aging process. And then we're going to bring on not one, but two special guests today. Our first special guest is Steve Aftergood of the Federation of American Scientists based in Washington, D.C. And we're going to talk about the curious case of Dr. Wenho Li. It turns out that now practically every day there's some kind of reversal, some kind of new development in that case. Even though a federal judge ordered Dr. Wenho Li to be released on bail, then the government pulled out a wild card at the very last minute to keep him incarcerated. It turns out that every day there's some kind of new unexpected twist and turn in the case. And Steve Aftergood of the Federation of American Scientists in Washington will help us to understand the larger implications of the case. And then we'll bring on our second special guest, Mr. Ross Geltzban, author of the book The Heat Is On, will talk to us about the latest concerning the greenhouse effect. Last month, we reported that the North Pole has now been reduced to a puddle of water, complete melting at the very top of the Earth. But also, we have new reports stating that Dr. James Hansen, one of the leading environmentalists pushing action on the greenhouse effect, is, quote, backtracking, unquote, on carbon dioxide emissions. So we'll begin to talk about precisely what Dr. Hansen did or did not say that was in some sense misread by the media. And then in the second half of Exploration, of course, we will be taking listener phone calls. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The top story comes from California, where a unanimous decision by the California